Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Tom Boyd, and he'll be answering your most important questions on Mongolia. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. You'll see a form on the right-hand column. Just fill in your name and email address, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Tom Boyd about Mongolia, a one-of-a-kind adventure. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kick boats, I'm convinced that the Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing." Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. Again, that's BigSkyInflatables.com. Before we introduce Tom, we'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in the drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Tom's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form. We'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away some free passes to the Fly Fishing Show, courtesy of Ben Framinski of the Fly Fishing Show. So hang in there for that. And we'll also be giving away a copy of Tom's soon-to-be-published book called Trout, Salmon, and Char, courtesy of Wild River Press. So to win these passes or Tom's new book, Trout, Salmon, and Char, you'll need to be one of the people that answer the questions at the end of the show. The question will be something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and you may win one of these three prizes. So you have three chances to win tonight in the Q&A contest. So take good notes, listen up, and maybe you'll win. Our guest tonight is Tom Boyd. Tom is a fishing consultant, instructor, outdoor writer, editor, and lecturer. He has over 50 years of experience as a catch-and-release fly fisherman. As a professional fisherman, he has traveled the world in pursuit of fresh and saltwater species. He specializes in game fish behavior and developing techniques to catch even the toughest species. As a fishing advocate, he champions the sport to everyone. Tom's book, Saltwater's Greatest Game Fish Techniques and Tactics to Catch the Top 35 Species, with notes on rankings and speed, was published by Stackpole Books and is available on Amazon or from Stackpole. And then, of course, his recent book, that will be hopefully off the presses in December, was Trout, Salmon, and Char from Wild River Press. Well, Tom, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you safe and home after what I'm sure we're going to find out is an incredible adventure here. So I'm very anxious to hear about it. So and like we said in your bio, you know, you fished all over the world, and we're going to talk about Mongolia tonight. I want to get into the country and what it was like there and so forth, but before I even do that, what made you consider going there? I mean, what prompted you to do this, to set up this whole adventure?
Well, Roger, as you know, we my son Jeff and I, who's the co-author of our new book, Trout, Salmon, and Char, we're not only professional fly fishermen, but we've been researchers for years. I've been for over 40 years, maybe 45 years. Jeff has been with me doing research on, well, saltwater fish, but more recently on, for quite a while, on freshwater fish, and particularly salmonids, and some of the rarest salmonids on Earth, and some the only ones that I'm aware of that we haven't caught were in Mongolia. So it was absolutely on the top of my bucket list. You know, they have incredible taimen, which are the largest salmon trout. They have lennep, which are the oldest. They've got a bunch of different kind of graylings, and we just wanted to go and find out about them. You know, we write about a lot of species, and this was a blank for us. We researched them, but from afar. We wanted to get up close and personal and find out about these species and catch them.
Good. Let's talk about Mongolia, because it's one of those wilderness areas still in many respects, and hard to get to, far away. I think we all have a general sense of where it is, but you want to describe its position and maybe a little bit about, you know, its
Yes, well, it's stuck.
Yeah,
it's in, stuck is a good term. It's in Central Asia, and it's stuck between Russia and China.
Yeah.
It's completely landlocked, and you're right about it being. It's not a very populous country. In fact, of all the countries in the world, it has the second lowest population density. Only Greenland has a lower population. It's got about 3 million people, and half of them live in its capital, and the other half are nomads spread throughout the steppes, living much like they did way back in the days of Genghis Khan.
Yeah. I think last year I listened to the audiobook on Genghis Khan and was amazed that such a empire was built out of, you know, an area such as Mongolia. It seems hard to believe that he almost conquered.
Yeah, when you read, as a matter of fact, he conquered more than any other ruler conquer, you know, from the Greeks or the Romans, the Huns, anybody. He ruled from Europe to the Pacific. It was incredible.
Right. Yeah, incredible. How many square miles is it? How big is the country?
Well, it's a little over 600,000 square miles, which means it's about a sixth the size of the United States, and it's about 2.5 times the size of Texas. So,
okay.
You know, it's a big country. It is truly a big country. What makes it even bigger, and I mean really big, is that it barely has a road system. I mean, a couple of the larger cities are connected, but once you get outside of the capital, you know, you're pretty much running on the steppes over roads that don't exist, or you're just driving wherever you can.
Yeah, that's that was one of my questions is, you know, what was the topography like there? So really just no fences, I take it. You know, you couldn't do that in the West United States. You run into a fence and, you know, no time at all. So unfenced.
Well, the topography, though, is really different. I mean, for the topography, if you get on the south, most of your listeners probably heard of the Gobi Desert, and that's where it's at. It's in southern Mongolia. And if you... It's completely different. If you go to the eastern part, that's the Amur River Basin, and it's one of the largest protected areas in the world. It's huge. If you go to the north, and that's where we were mostly, the central and the north areas, and that's the lakes area. And they have lakes up there. For example, we stayed in a gear camp, a soft-sided structure on Lake Kosoval, and I'm not pronouncing that right, but it's the second purest lake in the world, next to Lake Baikal. And in fact, the river that drains it, the Selenge, goes into Lake Baikal. And that lake, when it, the waters are so pure there, it's so incredible. In the winter, they freeze over, the people will clean the snow off it, the lake, and they can look through several feet of ice and see the water below and the animal life that's in it. You know, and then you go to the west, western part, and that's mountains. They have mountains that are over 17,000 feet. So the topography of the country is very, very diverse.
Yeah, yeah. So you were primarily in the northern part. I'm getting ahead of it. That's where you spent your time, close to the border, or?
I'm sorry, Roger, I lost you there.
Okay. I said, what part of Mongolia did you go to then for the fishing?
Well, when we went fishing, we went to the north central part. We stopped by and fished several rivers, but our goal, when we first went there, we were going to fish the Egg River and the Ur River. They're very famous. But we had the opportunity through, you know, Fly Shop Mongolia, who are native Mongolians, to fish an area where no Westerners had ever fished before. And this is the Shishgid Tengiz National Park. And it's a really, really protected area, Roger. It was, but we had the opportunity to fish there, and it was difficult to get there. You have to keep in mind, we were in, our trip was more than 3 weeks, and we were in Mongolia on the ground for over 19 days. And a lot of those days were just trying to get to where we were going. It's extremely remote. Again, no roads. We drove across the steppes and up mountains. And when I got home, I calculated that as the crow flies, we had driven about 1,200 miles. And believe me, you know, it was never in it as the crow flies. I don't think we ever drove in a straight line. We were up and down and sideways, and it was just exciting going where we went. And the only thing we had was dead reckoning, and we did have GPS, though, but a number of times we had to stop and ask the nomads for directions. And they were so friendly. I mean, the nomads, they're unbelievable. I mean, this is such a rich culture. And some of them invited us into their homes, and it was incredible. It was really wonderful.
Now, you had mentioned this. Did you use the outfitter there?
Yes, we did. We did, yes. We went there originally. My lifelong friend Jim Newman is an outfitter here with Triple Dare in California. And Jim had, he's traveled all over the world. And he went to Mongolia a couple of years ago through Travel Nomad, and he just fell in love with the place. And that's another reason that I went there. Jim, who I trust, he's the most honorable person you'd ever want to meet. And he called and said, Tom, you will not believe this. This was his favorite trip, you know, ever. And again, Jim is 76 and has been traveling around the world forever. And so that was really, through them, I met Fly Shop Mongolia, and while we were there, I went fishing with Fly Shop Mongolia. In fact, they had to send a crew ahead the week before we went there to try to blaze away and find a campsite on the Shishgid River, and we wanted to fish there because where we fished, nobody had ever fished before, and they said that the chances of catching these rare giant taimen were better there, that there were better chances of catching trophy fish there than anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, are they the only outfitter there? Are there other outfitters?
No, there are several other outfitters there. There are, I know Sweetwater Travel goes there. I think there is a Mongolian outfitters. There are a couple, but they have, as does Fly Shop Mongolia, they have camps on the Egg River, the Ur River, the famous rivers. They also have, in the Amur drainage, the Onion River, and it's B-A-L-J, Bals River. And this is in the homeland of Chinggis Khan, and these are also excellent rivers and in a national park. But as far as I know, Fly Shot Mongolia is the only one that can access the area that we went to in the Tangish Shingid National Park.
Okay. On a normal, it sounds like your trip was a bit different than maybe what the average five.
You can say that
going.
Again.
Yeah. What is a normal trip? Do people go there for a week normally, like other places?
Normally a little longer. They offer 6 days fishing, but even the eastern areas like the Egg or the Ur, or the Onion, they're a little difficult to get to. They're for, I would say on average, maybe an 8 day trip where you have 6 days fishing. For the Shishgud, and by the way, kind of trips, I talked to Fly Shop Mongolia because those kind of trips like the Egg and so forth, they normally run starting in the mid $6,000 range, $6,500, $6,600, up to in the mid $7,000s. And we're starting a program till they get well established. They have three lodges now, but until they get established in the United States, they're going to offer trips in the mid $3,000s plus fishing license or of about $330. So we're talking in the high $3,000 range, under $4,000. The Shishgud is a different story altogether. I mean, the travel just to get there, the only way you could get there is by four-wheel drive vehicle where there are no roads, or it's possible that you might be able to fly in there by a helicopter, but it takes many days each way just to access that area.
Yeah. How do you get there by air?
Well, we went from San Francisco. We went through Beijing, and we purposely had a day layover there so we could visit the Great Wall. And it's such a long trip, it was nice to break up the trip. However, I don't think Americans are treated very well by the Chinese. They're not.
Oh.
And so I think that when we go back, and we're going to go back next year, I think we're going to go through Seoul in Korea.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah, hopefully Seoul will still be there.
They broke a lot of our – we had a lot of highly – I know my son's drone, they just ripped it apart. I mean, I don't know if they were looking for something secret in the drone, but we're active with IGFA, and I had my granddaughters with me, and I had brought some certified tapes and certified scales by IGFA because the world records for – Taman and so forth are wide open for women, and the girls each caught world record fish, but we couldn't weigh them because they smashed the scale, the Chinese.
Seriously, wow.
Yeah,
wow.
It was. Jim Newman warned us of that. He said the people in their airlines going through security and all that kind of stuff were not friendly, and they weren't to us. And I hate to say that, but it's true.
And then you went from Beijing straight to
to Ubi. The capital's got five A's in it. it's Ulaanbaatar is the capital. Everybody calls it Ubi, including me, because I can't pronounce it. But we went straight there, and that's a fascinating town. That was more typical, Roger, of a big city. There's 1.5 million people there, and the town is booming. Not so anywhere else in Mongolia, but they have they only got their independence, Mongolia, from Russia in 1990. And by the way, the United States had a lot to do with that, with the breakup of the Soviet Union. And so Mongolians may not like the Chinese very much or the Russians very much, but they like Americans, you know. And when they got their independence in 1990, I don't think that would have happened if it were not for us. But since then, the Chinese and the Russians, they're rich in minerals and oil and all kinds of things like that, and especially precious metals, gold, silver, and these are some of the most toxic kind of mines. And you could see evidence of mining over Mongolia. And I think a lot of times the Chinese and the Russians, you know, are not conservationists in their own country. This certainly didn't appear to be conservation-minded in Mongolia.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Tom, time to take a quick break here. So hang tight, and we'll be right back, and we'll talk more about fly fishing in Mongolia. Looking for shot at a permit? Whipraki Fishing Lodge in Belize is where you want to be. When you stay at Whipraki Fishing Lodge, you're on a private island and only minutes away from some of the finest permit fishing in Belize. Whipraki is just a 30-minute boat ride from Placentia. Once you're there, you'll be fishing Permit Alley, one of Belize's best fisheries, and you won't be taking long boat rides to get started. You'll fish with world-class guides like Daniel Cabral, whose family has fished the area for over 30 years. Want to switch it up and fish for tarpon and bonefish and make it a grand slam? They can make it happen at Whipraki Fishing Lodge. Book your next adventure now. Visit WhipRakeyFishingLodge.com. Again, that's WhipRakeyFishingLodge.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tom Boyd about Mongolia, a one-of-a-kind adventure. If you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage at AskAboutFlyFishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Tom, I always ask my guests, hey, what's going on in your fly fishing world? So tell us, beyond the Mongolia trip, what else you're up to nowadays?
Well, my son Jeff and I, again, we're researchers, and after Mongolia, we went up to the Drifter's Lodge in Alaska. We got back, and we're really been working hard on our book and writing articles. As a matter of fact, I stayed up all last night and wrote an article for a magazine out of South Africa, The Complete Fly Fisherman. Of course, I'm with Fly Fish America magazine. I'm their editor at large. Jeff and I are doing articles for them. We've been doing a lot of planning. We have just formed Team Boyd. I've had a lot of people that were interested in following and fishing with me over the years, but we were pretty much too much involved in the research. But now we're doing more and more of that, and we decided that we would form, and plus we have my two granddaughters, Julia and KK Boyd. They're 20 and 23 years old, and they're very interested in doing the kind of work that Jeff and I do. So we brought them along, and with a good friend and like an adopted son, Mike Marshall, we formed Team Boyd to do research. And what we're doing now for the first time, we're going to see if we can attract members that might want to fish with us. We have a lot of advantages. You know, we're going to be doing things like, you know, tagging and fin clips and DNA genetic work on fish, exploring new areas. And we're very fortunate to be able to fish some areas that are unique. I mean, we often explore areas where nobody has ever been before. And in any event, we want to try to pass some of this on, get some of the people working. We're doing this now with Fly Shop Mongolia. And part of our agreement with Team Boyd and Fly Shop Mongolia is that we would work as best we could to help with the endangered taimen. They're either threatened or endangered in most of their range. They used to be from Western Europe all the way to the Pacific. And now the last probably stronghold is in Mongolia and a few parts of Siberia. There are some funds like the Taimen Fund and some organizations that are working, but we want to try to see if we can do some satellite tagging and find out more about these fish. Nobody really knows about Lennox or Taimen or some of the various grayling species and Amur pike and some of the game fish that are in Mongolia. People, they don't even know they exist, let alone they have a giant black Mongolian grayling that's only in one lake and river system. We're going to try for that next year. And they get huge, way bigger than the 5-pound, 15-ounce world record grayling. So we're pretty busy. We're starting on 3 new books as well.
Oh, wow. You guys are busy.
Yes.
Good for you.
I'll say what Lefty Cray always used to say. I've completely failed retirement.
There you go. Yeah, well, so in your upcoming book, Trout, Salmon, and Char, will be off the presses hopefully in December, you said?
Coming in December. If anybody would like to get an autographed copy, they can contact, or if they're interested in Team Boyd, just contact me. They can see some information on Facebook, Tom Boyd on Facebook, but if they call me at TBOYD2020@yahoo.com, TomBoyd2020@yahoo.com, and I'm just setting up a new website right now. It's up. It's not complete, but it's TomBoydFishing.com, and also Fly Shop Mongolia. They're www.flyshopmongolia.com. So at those sites, you can find out more. And again, if you're interested in Team Boyd, and we're going to be able to get some discount in some places and do things that are really fabulous.
Yeah. Cool. Well, good. Well, thanks for sharing all that with us.
Yes, sir.
Exciting. Okay.
And
back
we do
to,
have a good.
Pardon me?
I said, and we do have a good time.
Yeah, I bet.
Well, we just love to do this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I can tell. Yeah, and the places you go and the things you do, it's incredible. Well, let's talk more about Mongolia. What was the weather like when you were there, and what would be the best time of year to go there fishing?
When we were there, it was great. I think Mongolia is different. China, Russia, a lot of that influences from the Pacific. But the air currents that influence Mongolia are from the Arctic. Of course, so is Siberia, part of Russia. But so it can get chilly. It was beautiful when we were there. I live in Fort Collins, Colorado, and the weather there was like it was here. It was really nice. But when we left in mid-September, we could see in the mountains there was snow. The best time to go fishing, the season, it opens in Mongolia June the 15th. The taimen and others spawn, and the season is closed. So it opens, and that's right after ISA, and that's a great time to go for all the species because, you know, the Mongolian winters are long and harsh, and the fish are all ravenous. And the fishing stays good probably till mid-July. From mid-July to mid-August, the fishing is still good, but it's iffy. You get a lot of melt. You get a lot of runoff, and you get high water at that time. And I always say about high water, it's the kiss of death. So, but by mid-August to when it gets too cold, you know, mid-October, that's prime time. That's the fish then are hungry, they're trying to put on some calories for winter, and that's a great time.
Okay, good. And how did you plan out the trip? Did you let the outfitter take care of it, or did you tell them where you wanted to go, or how did the plan come about?
Well, fishing, that was we handled that with Fly Shop Mongolia and with Jim Newman and Travel Nomads. But Travel Nomad and Jim Newman, they provided all kinds of activities. I mean, once we got into UB, we visited some incredible museums. And we stopped. The girls, my granddaughters, KK and Julia, you know, they rode horseback. They rode up to an ancient volcano. It was 3 hours horseback each way. They rode camels, two-hump camels. They're unbelievable. And so forth. We stopped at famous sites all through Mongolia. A lot of them were destroyed by the Russians in the 1930s when they invaded Mongolia. But some of these areas, like Buddhist monasteries and so forth, would be, out in the middle of nowhere. And some of those survived, and we visited some of those, and it was fascinating. I mean, it really was. Again, their culture is so markedly different than anything any of us had any experience before, and it's so rich, it was incredible, and it's one of the few places that you can travel on Earth to where we were welcomed into homes and we were safe.
Nice. Yeah. So when you so Travel Nomads was another organization that did these other tours, non-fishing tours.
Yes. 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 They don't specialize in the fishing, but if you want to do a tour, you know, Jim Newman with Triple Dare and Travel Nomads, both are terrific. They really are.
Yeah. Good. Good. Okay. So from UB, was it four-wheel drive from UB on out? What was the ground?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Okay. Well, UB and horseback and camel, yeah, we were in four-wheel drives, and I'll tell you what, we sometimes where we needed to go, we would stop and get out, and our guides, you know, would go forward trying to find a way through for us. There, as we drove across rivers, it was fascinating. I mean, it was we had several vehicles, so if one got stuck, the other one could help. But it was truly fascinating. I laughed a lot because you'd be driving down this area where maybe 10 other four-wheel drive vehicles had ever driven, and you'd see a tiny little sign, you know. I mean, and it was like it would show you're looking up at this mountain, and they would show maybe a 6-inch triangular sign that would show a vehicle going up a steep grade, you know, and I just laugh, you know, because it was, I'd think, how could anybody put a sign on this thing? It's not even a road. We went across bridges that were private bridges that I'll tell you, they were, you know, we walked across a couple of them, and on a couple of them, they were toll booths, local people, and we laughed so hard, I laughed till I cried. I'm saying, that, you know, they had to take some of that toll money and build a real bridge here, you know.
Oh, geez. Yeah, did the what kind of vehicles did they have? I mean, what make, models, kind of things did they use?
Well, I'm not familiar with the they had a Russian vehicle, two Russian vehicles that were kind of like vans, power wagons. But the Fly Shot Mongolia guys had, you know, expensive four-wheel drive vehicles. Up there, they really need something that's good. If you get on my site or their site, you can see some of the places they access are on horseback or by camel. I mean, some of the places that they go are, they have, you know, fixed-sided, real comfortable lodges. But if you want to get out on the edge, like I do often and my son Jeff does, you know, they can access some of these headwaters all kind of ways. As a matter of fact, one of the partners in the fly shop has a brother that has a helicopter company. So we've been talking about that. And the partners, by the way, are Essie Suki, Amara Sims, and Ganbat. And I'm going to do the best I can on Ganbat's name because it's got about 18 letters in it. But it's basically... Seven Regin is my best effort at pronouncing. And these are three young businessmen that opened the first and only fly shop in Mongolia. And we laughed about that, too. I said, you know, that's a good way to go broke. I mean, because in Mongolia, everybody fishes with spinning rods and spinners or, you know, hand lines and things like that. There aren't a whole lot of fly fishermen, and I just thought that was a great thought, because what they're trying to do is influence the country to change for the benefit of the Taman and the Lenok and so forth. These guys go out and catch them, you know, with grappling hooks, drill through the ice and catch them with live bait and kill them, or catch them, you know, with lures that have lots of treble hooks on them and so forth. So I commend these three young, bright Mongolians for their effort.
So they are trying to do something politically to protect these areas, or what's...
Yeah, they are. In fact, in order for Team Boyd, Jeff and I have a lot of opportunities, and we work on this kind of stuff, but we're really committed to this because there's so much work that has to be done. We talked about specific things, like we want to do some satellite tagging. Like Lenok and Taman, people really don't even know how old they are. That they did a study about 15 years ago in the Egg River, and they found out that the biomass for Taman had dropped 50%. It's rumored, and the biggest taimen that was ever caught was 6 feet 11, that we know of, was 6 feet 11 and weighed 231 pounds, and that was in Russia. They don't catch them like that anymore. Its close relative, the Danube trout, or a Hutchin, they're extremely endangered. They're almost extinct. So some people had to step up and do something. The Mongolian government is trying. The problem is it's a poor country. They don't have the money. But they're trying to work to protect their headwaters, the government. But there's a lot of money in from the Chinese and the Russians to open up mines, and those mines are in the same areas that the fishing is good.
Yeah. Very interesting. Where did you stay? I mean, did they have fixed camps? Did you set up camp on the fly? How was that?
Well, they did, but we didn't. They have several lodges. We bypassed them, and we stayed in what they call gir camps. A gir is the traditional type of Mongolian housing, and it's a rather large, round tent with a hole in the middle. It's a soft-walled area. And we would stay typically in those kinds of camps. And it took us, you know, again, 4 days, 5 days just to get to the Tingis Shishked National Park and watershed. So we got a chance to stay in a lot of gear camps. They did build, they are building the Fly Shop Mongolia, a new site on a lake. But it wasn't finished, and they have wood cabins, but it wasn't finished. But we stayed there and we roughed it, but it was exciting. Even the camp that they put up with us, the tent camp, we had they would over an open fire they would make hot water for us to take showers. They have a little boy and girl potty that they made. We had a little tent dining hall. They brought in a chef, and he was absolutely phenomenal, especially because we had limited stores. I mean, it wasn't like you could just go to the store. If you didn't bring it, it wasn't there. Nobody had ever been there before.
Yeah. What was the food like? I mean, was it American food?
The food that they made for us was great. And we did traditional things. For example, they asked, you know, would you like to, when we were at the camp on the lake that they were just finishing, I can't pronounce it. But in any event, they said, would you like to have a traditional mutton? And I said, okay. And I said, I'm not a mutton fan, but, yeah, if that's the tradition, we'd like to try it. They went right out and grabbed a sheep and killed it right there. And,
oh, jeez.
I mean, it was
not, fresh, huh?
I told my granddaughters, I said, I don't think you want to see this. But, I mean, it's the way they do. They raise all the animals that they raise, Roger, including horses, the five mouths. They call the five mouths. They raise horses, and they feed it, but they also eat them. They like to eat the horses because they think they give them great strength and vigor. But the second of the five mouths are yaks and cows. They count them as one mouth because they can interbreed. But camels are the third, sheep are the fourth, and goats are the fifth. So those six species comprise the five mouths, and everything they raise, they slaughter and eat, or they sell, or they take the wool, because the yak and their goats and lambs, they make Mongolian fur, which is cashmere, which is the best in the world. I think it's the best because the conditions of winters are so harsh with the Arctic winds that their fur, their wool is very, very dense.
Yeah. Did you need any security? Was there any security?
Well, we did. I've never seen anything like this. When we got up to the final fixed camp, the one that they're outfitting, and I apologize for not being able to pronounce the name, but the head of the border patrol for that area, and this little village, there was only about, you know, maybe 1,000 people in it, and he came over and talked to us. He didn't speak English, but, you know, our guide spoke English, and Essie, one of the three partners, He talked to them, and they assigned a guard to us. His name was Bobby. He was so friendly, but he also carried an AK-47 with him. And everywhere we went, he went carrying that AK-47. I was teasing him about he couldn't shoot any Taman, you know.
Yeah.
We were so close to the Siberian border. As a matter of fact, Bobby, and he didn't speak any English, nor did some of our guides, but it's amazing how well we got along, that we communicated. You know why? Because they're just so darn nice. They're so caring, and they anticipate what you need, and they do it. I mean, they're just great. And Bobby, our guide, our security guard, he came with us, and we just enjoyed the heck out of him. It was really a lot of, other than just being immersed in this incredible culture, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Okay, Tom, time to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about the fishing and what it was like, how you did it, and so forth. So hang tight, everyone. We'll be right back. Baja Fly Fishing Company is dedicated to fulfilling your vacation dreams. And just so there's no mistake, they derive as much pleasure helping a novice improve as they do fishing with a pro. From the casual to the hardcore, they can match your expectations with their experience and coaching. A vacation with Baja Fly Fishing is more than a fishing trip. It's a full-on Baja experience that you will remember forever. They know the Baja after 40 years of traveling its back roads, kayaking its shoreline, surfing and snorkeling while pioneering the fly fishing techniques that have evolved into the tactics used today. They are well-versed in fly fishing the beach, in kayaks, on pongas, and are well-versed in all tackle types. Join them in pursuit of roosterfish, dorado, marlin, sailfish, wahoo, jack crevalle, yellowfin, skipjack, and many other species. Learn more about Baja Fly Fishing Company by visiting their website at bajaflyfish.com. Again, that's bajaflyfish.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Tom Boyd about Mongolia, a one-of-a-kind adventure. If you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage and fill out that form and send your question in, and we'll try to answer it on the show tonight. Okay, so, Tom, you've been mentioning a bunch of rivers. How many different rivers did you fish?
Well, we only fished three.
Three.
We had the Tengas, the Shishked, and a little river called the Goat. So we just fished three, but the famous rivers there that are well known and draw a lot of all of the outfitters are the Egg River, the Ur River, the Onan River. The Onan, again, is in the home. These are all in national parks. The Onan is in the east, and it's the headwaters of the Amur, the giant Amur river drainage. And the Amur is, they're protecting that now, and that's in northern China. But that's, you might recognize, like the Amur tiger, the largest tigers in the world, even larger than Siberian tigers, the Amur leopard. And by the way, these are very severely endangered species. And this is the headwaters, the Onan, and again, the home place and sacred to the Mongols and the home place of Genghis Khan.
Yeah. Now, so how did the rivers differ from one or the other, or were they, all fairly similar as far as depth and,
Well, the one that stood out as the most different, I mean, the Egg River and the Ur River are beautiful. They're all beautiful rivers. These are all in national parks. I mean, these are in the most beautiful areas, I think, of Mongolia. So they're all beautiful. The Ur and the Egg River, the river that flows out of Lake Kosoval, the Shenga, they are all pretty good-sized rivers. I mean, you can float them and for days. I mean, they're all big, long rivers that are productive. Like some of the others that we fish, in the Egg River, they've got Fly Shot Mongolia fishes five smaller rivers as well. The same thing in the Onan. There's the BALJ, I can't pronounce that, but and three other rivers that they fish, and they're all smaller streams. And they're all wadeable. They're absolutely loaded with grayling, a bunch of different kind of grayling. And I mean, you put your fly in the water and any dry fly, and you catch them. It's difficult, say, to catch linnet because the grayling will eat your fly first. But okay. The most different river was the Shishkit. And the Shishkit is crystal clear. I mean crystal clear. It's very shallow. It varies from about a 50 to 100, over 100 feet wide, maybe even as much as 120 or 30 feet wide. And the thing that really makes it unusual is it's in a hurry. I mean, it's fast. You have to watch yourself when you're waiting. I mean, even if you're waiting in only knee-deep water, you can feel the current. And the difference with the Shishkit was, in order to protect the taimen, you're not allowed to fish from a boat. So you're not allowed to have an anchor. So they have additional rules for that watershed to, you know, restrict and, frankly, make it harder to catch a taimen. The rules there are fly fishing only, single barbless hook, period. They're not allowed to fish with other kinds of hardware there. And even in the lower sections of the Shishkit, they are limited to 140 rods per year. The area that we fished, we're negotiating right now, and we think we're going to have the opportunity to only have 36 rods. So we can have 36 people go there to fish.
In what period of time?
The whole year.
The whole year.
Yeah. These are the Mongolian government, and we hope to talk to them on our next trip. The people that are, because there's only one man really that's making the decisions on this, and we want to try to get some input there, because we have a lot of experience in doing this and protecting, you know, individual species and so forth over the years, but it's. It truly, Roger, this is a unique fishery. You can see that they're really trying to do the right thing, but it's lack of resources and a lot of money pushing back the other way.
Yeah. Well, now, did you fish any lakes this time? I know you said next time.
No, we didn't. One, there are a few taimen in lakes, but not many. Next year, there's one in the mountains, in the high mountains in the west. There's one river and a few small lakes that have these giant Mongolian grayling. And we've talked to the Fly Shop Mongolia guys, and we want to try to do that, especially for the girls, because the grayling books are wide open. They've got grayling that are 32 inches. I mean, I've caught a lot of grayling, and I've never caught one over 22 or 23. That's about my top. And you catch a 24-inch grayling, you're doing something. And they say they have them up there 70 to 80 centimeters.
Wow. Now, and then what species did you fish for this time?
Okay, well, what we targeted was that were taimen, and they're tough. Okay. There aren't many of them. They're big. So I targeted especially the taimen. But we absolutely had a ball. I mean, we had a ball with the lennet and the grayling. You know, the lennet are incredible, and you can catch almost as many as you want. The grayling, you can catch as many as you want. I mean, they are I had one of the – we were doing things like, you know, Amara and Essie and Jeff and I were working with the girls on, you know, techniques to catch fish. And one of the other guys came up and said, can I borrow one of the fly rods, and picked out any little fly and went out and would make a cast, and within 2 seconds he'd have a grayling. It's amazing.
Now, I know in your notes you sent me, you also talking about northern pike. Did you fish for those at all this time?
But we didn't. We didn't get a chance. We could have. There are, and I'll tell you what, they're absolutely amazing. They're called the Amur pike, and they're, again, they occur over in the Onion and the Amur River drainage. And they get as big as our pike, but they look totally different. I mean, if you look at one of these guys, they look like they've got some brown trout in their lineage. They're covered with big brown spots, and I mean, even their gill plates, even up underneath their eyes, all the way to their caudal fin, their tail fin. I mean, they're just loaded. They don't look like our northern pike, other than the body shape, of course. But
right, the mouth.
when you the head, they're you know, unmarkable. You know that that's a northern pike. But I'll tell you, their coloration is completely different. And I'd love to see somebody do some genetic testing on these, on a Amur pike compared to the pike in, say, North America, northern pike over here.
Yeah, interesting. So let's talk about that. Well, what rods did you bring? I'm sure you brought a selection, but what weights did you?
Well, we did. One thing that the people, Fly Rod Mongolia, they had all their rods already fixed up, but we had better rods. and we used different rods for different things. For example, they recommended that we bring spey rods, and 9 and 10 weight spey rods to cast the giant flies that you have to cast for taming. But again, I teach tactics, and so does Jeff. I landed a 340-pound billfish on a 12-weight rod and a 20-pound tippet. So it was a blue marlin. So I mean, I brought then both Jeff and I used Temple Fork Outfitters 8-weight. It's 11-foot switch rod, but we used a new Sage X rod, 7-foot 10-weights. We used and 5-weights. They were, for the Lennox and the Grayling. The Grayling, you could have used even a smaller rod, although they fight like the Dickens, and they're big Grayling there. They really are. Matter of fact, KK, my granddaughter, she caught a really big one. It's a shame. I would say it was every bit of, it was over 4 pounds, and the biggest Grayling of all time, all tackle, was 5 pound, 15 ounces, and this was probably in a good 4.5 pounds or so. So, but we couldn't weigh it because our IGFA certified scale was messed up. But some of the Grayling, they get big.
So you had mentioned before, and I believe you said there's no drifting on, is it all of these rivers that we talked about?
No. On the Shishkit. The Shishkit
just on the Shishkit
is new, okay. And there's two areas that are absolutely protected. And it's called the Taman Sanctuary. And the first one was established in, I think it was 2008. And it's about, 4,000 square kilometers. And it's the Unan and the Amur headwaters. And the second sanctuary, I believe it was in 2013, I mean, fairly recently. And that's even bigger. That was 650 square kilometers, and it's and that's where this Shishkid and Tengis and some of these rivers are. So there's new regulations, and the toughest ones that I'm aware of, both in restricting the number of rods and how you can fish, are in the Shishkid and Tengis watershed.
Okay, so there you had to wade fish. Drive up to an area and work that area up and down the river for a period of time, and then move in the vehicles to another area. Is that?
And I'll tell you, it was really exciting because this isn't normally when you go to like to the Egg or the Ur, they're known rivers. They've fished these since probably back in the 80s, and some of the outfitters since the 90s. So their guides, they know every inch of those rivers. You know, they might float a stretch of 10 or 20 or 50 miles, but or more. But, they know the river. They know, where the fish are. Where we were at was a total exploratory trip. I mean, I was with Amara once, and we had a inflatable boat with, a jet boat engine. And we almost bought the farm. I mean, we filled right up with water in a tough area, because we were exploring. I mean, we were looking for areas. It wasn't like everybody knew, like, behind that rock, there's a big taimen. Right. We went down the river looking for areas, that might hold taimen. And I'll tell you, these guys are guides. I've got good vision for fish, and so does Jeff. But these guys were better. They could really see fish, you know. We saw lots of them. They saw a lot more.
So did you use where you did use boats? Is it mainly for transportation rather than fishing?
Oh, yeah, boat? Yeah. We would go down. You could choose whatever we wanted to do, whatever species we wanted to go for. I mean, whether we're going to go out for half a day or a full day. A couple of times we even had, remote spike camps. We'd take our gear and head, upstream, 10 miles or whatever, and, set up a campsite overnight, and the guys would cook. And by the way, it was unbelievable how good they made food, but that's how we would do. And we would spread out. There were only five of us, but we would spread out on the river. We tried to vary, who we fished with. Mike Marshall, my granddaughters, Jeff and I. Jeff and I didn't fish together too much, and normally we're inseparable. Normally we go everywhere together, fish together, research together, and so forth. But since we're professionals, we divided up to try to help the girls, and they really did well, and Mike Marshall as well.
Yeah, cool. Let's take another quick break here, and then when we come back, let's talk about each of the fish and what it was like fishing for them. So hang tight with me, Tom. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Fly Fishers International needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. The organization provides grants to help with restoration of habitats like Wolf Creek in Idaho and Sands Creek in Upper Delaware in New York, and funds projects that collect valuable data about fish and their habitats, like the Peacock Bass Study in Miami, Florida. Fly Fishers International's core values remain unchanged: to serve as a strong advocate for fly fishing in all waters for all of fish, to preserve and to promote the arts of fly casting and fly tying, and to help ensure future generations can continue to enjoy these one-of-a-kind experiences. These efforts won't be nearly as effective without your help. If you're not already a member, we invite you to join Fly Fishers International as they work to cultivate conservation, education, and community within the sport of fly fishing. Join Fly Fishers International today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to their website at flyfishersinternational.org. Again, that's flyfishersinternational.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Tom Boyd about Mongolia, a one-of-a-kind adventure. If you'd like to ask a question, just go to our homepage, fill out that form, and we'll try to answer your questions tonight on the show. Okay, Tom, let's break these fish down in the last segment we have here. Let's talk about the taimen, first of all. Describe the fish and, its characteristics and so forth, and what you learned about it when you were over there.
Well, the taimen are, one, they're the largest member of the Samanidae family, which includes salmon, trout, and whitefish. The largest on record that I mentioned before was 6 feet 11 inches long. They say in days gone by that they were even bigger. They're a potamoraminous fish, which means they just are completely fresh water. They don't go in the salt. They exist in both the Arctic drainage and the Pacific drainage. They're primarily piscivorous, which means they eat fish. But of all the salmonids, I believe they are the most aggressive. They really are. I mean, on top, they'll eat ducks, muskrats, rats, anything that moves on top. As a matter of fact, they've been known to eat beavers. I mean, can you imagine that? I mean, do you have any beaver flies with you? I mean, they're incredible. I mean,
you'd have to bring a whole suitcase just for the beaver flies.
Well, some of the ones we had Pat Cohen and Tammy Ziegler tie flies for us, and they're a couple of the best tires, especially with deer hair, you know, on planet Earth. And some of the flies, we had to go get special fly boxes just to hold these. And, for example, the first time I was fishing with Mike, and we saw a taimen behind a rock going by that was over 5 feet long. And we stopped, and I jumped up on this rock because I was up. And my guide saw the size of the taimen, and he took three of these beautiful, beautiful, giant 10-inch, 11-inch flies, grabbed three of them, tied them all together. And I flipped this. It looked like a damn colored mop flipped it, and this taimen came right after it, and the fool missed it. I didn't get him, but I'll tell you what, that would have been, he was right there, fearless, and so I don't think you could throw a fly that was too big. It was incredible. But the taimen,
they're not particularly spooky?
Oh, no, they're aggressive. Well, in here, there's no sophistication here. It's not like, you know, you get a brown trout and, you know, you catch them a couple of times and it's really hard to catch them again. They become sophisticated. They've never seen a fly. Plus, the taimen, one of the reasons they're endangered is they're so aggressive. They're difficult to catch because their numbers are down. But, boy, they'll come from far away. You don't have to have a perfect drift or a dry drift. They'll come up and take dry flies. They really do. They are more aggressive on the surface than anything I know. And their first move, you think you have a steelhead or an Atlantic salmon, their first move is up. They jump like crazy. But in appearance, they're long, they're slender, they're more slender than any of the other salmon species and most of the other trout species. They have their characteristic color is their caudal fin, their tail fin is kind of like a orange brown, and their anal fin is orange brown, and part of the rear part of their body. That's their characteristic signature. And when it comes time for spawn, they get redder. But they're a beautiful fish. But what separates them is their size. I mean, they get the 40 inches considered a good fish. 50 inches and up is a trophy fish. The IGFA record is about, it's in the 90s. I forget, 92, 93 pounds, something like that. But if we were fly fishing for them or any kind of fishing for them 100 years ago, stories that I've heard are that they were over 250 or 300 pounds. I mean, in fact, in the Arctic drainage where they, or the Pacific drainage rather, where they cohabit with king salmon, they eat king salmon. Where's your king salmon fly?
Yeah. Well, what kind of fly did you take over there to use then? And
we emulated grayling. As piscivores, they eat other fish. So most of our streamer patterns that we took were emulated grayling, lennock, and small taimen because they eat their own. We also took on top, we took some really big articulated rat patterns. These are, not counting the tail, they would be 6 or 7 inch long flies and bulky. I mean, these were, you know, deer hair patterns. We also took some girdlers. They work white girdlers that might emulate, you know, grayling on top. So those were the primary patterns. However, if there was a prevailing hatch, these taimen, they'll come up and eat flies. And for the best opportunity, there's lots and lots of grasshoppers. I mean, I filmed one day four different species of grasshopper. They're loaded. So the taimen will eat those grasshoppers like crazy when they're available. And they also, Amara was just in teaching the girls, he put on, he didn't use an indicator, but he fished a nymph and caught, you know, maybe about a 30-inch taimen. So they were talking about in grasshopper season, you know, using the grasshopper fly as your indicator and put a nymph dropper. And they said you could catch some big taimen that way.
So you were you do run into smaller taimen as well, huh?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, the biggest taimen that I got was only 40 inches. But it took a big grayling pattern, and I'll tell you what, he hit that. I mean, they are so aggressive, and immediately he was airborne. And before I could even, you know, get him on the reel, he'd already, you know, made four or five jumps. And I'll tell you what, they are really, really strong. They are spectacular fighters. They truly are. And when I'll tell you what, when I got him in, I thought, and I'm pretty good at this. I mean, I've caught a fish or two in my time, and I thought he was a bigger fish. When I got him in and he was only 40 inches, he fought bigger than that. It was one heck of a fight.
Now, well, we had a question here. These are not in particularly deep water, right? For the most part.
No.
I mean, what is the depth that you're fishing for these fish in?
It pretty shallow. I mean, they'll hold out in a deeper hole, but they like the white water, Roger. I mean, these guys are up in the white water, and typically the white water is the shallow water. They like that. They're high energy fish, and they like that high oxygen rate. That I don't know. You know, maybe rainbows will hold in water that's, you know, fast like this, but, you know, like the Lennox, we would find them in frog water or back eddies or next to the current. Occasionally we saw a tame in there, but we fished the white water. I mean, and the big fish.
So is that white water maybe white 3 feet deep or so? I mean, on average or deeper?
Well, yeah, I would say probably some less than that, but probably in the area from maybe 2 to 5 feet in that range.
Okay.
I mean, again,
okay.
It was eminently wadeable as far as depth goes, but you had to watch yourself with the speed of the current.
Now, Phil in Kentucky wrote in here on the Internet. He says, I get the impression that taemin have no deep water to head for when hooked. Is the fight that takes place a chaotic battle in shallow water?
It pretty much is, yeah. It's chaotic. I haven't caught one in a lake, but I think it would be chaotic in a lake too. But because they are a chaotic fish. They are, you know, I just wrote an article again on them last night, and I used, and I don't normally do this, but I said they are one angry, pissed off fish.
Yeah. Upset their day, huh? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, do you sight fish for the taemin or?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
You do.
You know, and that's one thing about that I really like, and that's not always. You know, some of the rivers, or sometimes early in the season, the waters haven't cleared as well. They're not as clear as they are late in the season when the water's lower and clearer. But yeah, we did. We spent half our time looking and the other half fishing. We would go find where we either where we know there were fish because we saw them, or where it looked like, you know, there would be fish there, and that's the kind of water. Then we had to get to shore and then, you know, try to get a favorable position to, you know, to cast to them.
Right. Let's talk about the Lennox. Describe that fish for me.
It's the oldest species of trout. I mean, they look a lot like a brown trout. They're beautiful fish, but the one big difference is they have an underbite. They look like they've got maybe a little bit of bonefish in their ancestry because they look like a brown trout. They've got, you know, they're kind of like from a silver yellow to a silver brown with lots of big brown spots, and I mean lots, probably more than brown trout on average, but they have like bands of orange on their side. They're beautiful. And in fact, when the spawn comes, they turn red. They spawn in the spring, so we weren't afforded, but they're beautiful fish even before they, you know, color up on the spawn. As far as numbers, there are quite a few of them. Their range is somewhat smaller than what it used to be. They're easy to catch. They're quite the opposite of brown trout in that, they're not sophisticated. They'll eat anything. They really do. If the grayling doesn't get it, they will. And they eat grayling as well. We used dry flies. KK and Julia were using, let me see if I can remember. They were using orange stimulators. They were using yellow grasshoppers. They were using orange bombers. They had a lot of fun with those. They caught a few on using nymphs. They were using prints, and they caught them with prince nymphs. And they fought well. They don't jump like the Taman do, but we've had them jump a couple times. The largest one, the record, is the all-tackle record is 9 pounds. In days of old, they were said to reach 100 pounds. Today, they say about the biggest known would get up to about 20 pounds, but the potential is there for them to get bigger. But they're very slow-growing, like Taman are. Taman, I think, and Lennox, now that they're protected, I'll bet as the years go by, we're going to be catching bigger and bigger fish because they're long-lived fish. You know, trout in this country, in our country, don't live that long. These guys, Taman, maybe 55 years. Nobody really knows, but they think that's, you know, that's possible. So the Lennox, I caught one on a weighted. I was using a floating line, weight forward floating, but I put on a big black articulated leech pattern, and I caught a 6.44-pound Lennox. That was my biggest fish. I think Julia and Mike and KK all caught bigger fish than that. But they said to break that 9-pound record, if we spent any time specializing on Lennox up on the Shishkit, that would be an easy thing to do. That's what, you know, Essie and Amara and Ganbat said.
Mm-hmm. Okay, okay. And then finally, the grayling. Tell us about the grayling there and how, you know, I'm familiar with grayling from Alaska and so forth. How do they differ, the ones that you were catching?
Arctic. Well, they have the Arctic grayling. We didn't catch any of them. We caught mostly what we caught, and these are really distinctive, were golden-tailed grayling. And all, I mean, you go back and they look like our Arctic grayling that we catch here in North America, and except you get back, the last third or quarter of their body is yellow. Boom, all of a sudden, it just turns to yellow. They're absolutely stunning fish. They also, in the east, there's an Amur grayling that's different. And I mentioned earlier, there's what they call the giant Mongolian grayling, or they refer to it as the black grayling. And that's the one that we hope to fish for next year. And Amara and Essie, our guides, they said that in the mountains, there's only one watershed that contains these fish. And they said, again, they were 70 to 80 centimeters, and that translates to 32 inches. And they showed us a couple of pictures that they had. As a matter of fact, the first picture that they showed me, and these are black, Essie said, look at this. And I said, what the heck is that? And then I looked because the fin wasn't up. The dorsal fin wasn't up. It was down, and it was black, and it was huge. And he said, that's a grayling. And I looked at it, and I said, you know, by gosh, that is a grayling. You know, I said, what in the heck kind of grayling is that? I'd never even heard of it. And here I am. I think we know as much about the salmonid family as anybody ever. And that was a new one on me. But, again, one single watershed, and they're big.
And all three of these were all basically in the same water.
Oh, yeah, the golden, yeah, the golden, yes. And if you went to the east on the Onion, you would find the Amur. And over there they have the Amur trout. That's another great, that they're as big as the Lennox, on average even bigger, and that's another unique species, the Amur trout. They look a lot like a brown trout as well, but they don't have the underbite like the Lennox does. And again, trophy, tough, they tell me, again, I haven't caught any because we didn't fish over in that watershed. It was more than 1,000 miles away, but they say they really are similar to fighting, you know, brown trout. You know, they're really a trophy, hard fighting fish.
Yeah, yeah. Now, but in any one of these watersheds that you were fishing in, you could catch a Taman, a Lennox, or a grayling all within the same river. Maybe different.
And we did. As a matter of fact,
yeah.
I know,
yeah.
KK, our first day when we got in, it was in the, you know, we got in, you know, fairly late, and she went right where our campsite was at. She went out with dries, and caught all three on dries. She caught a salmon, a lennox, and a tunnock. She caught a, I think, two lennox and a bunch of grayling and one taimen. So, yeah, there they were, and this is at our,
that's a good start.
She just waited out at our campsite.
Yeah, yeah.
We were having
very
a beer.
Yeah, very good, very good. But, Tom, it's time to wrap this up, but thanks. Stay with me just a few more minutes. We're going to try to give away your book and a few passes here and some other prizes. So hang tight with me just a few more minutes, and we'll do that. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry has united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit SaveBristolBay.org to learn more and to get involved. Again, visit SaveBristolBay.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away a few prizes, and the winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do for our next show so you have a chance to win one of these great prizes. Now, if you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and get the information from you so that we can get the prizes out to you. And the first thing we're going to give away tonight is a one-year membership to the Fly Fishers International. And to learn more about them, go to flyfishersinternational.org, flyfishersinternational.org. Great organization to support. They're doing a lot with conservation, and I'm sure you'll enjoy being a part of that. Our winner for that is Scott Nelson in Oregon. Scott Nelson in Oregon. So congratulations, Scott. I know Scott's been a longtime listener, so I'm glad you were able to win this prize. The second thing we're giving away is a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which you can learn more about at AmatoBooks.com. Again, this is Fly Fishing and Tying Journal at AmatoBooks.com. So check out their site. They have all kinds of periodicals as well as books on fly fishing. I'm sure you'll find something there that'll interest you. Our winner for that is Andy Cordova. Andy Cordova, another longtime listener in Nevada. So, Andy, congratulations on getting that subscription, and hope you have fun tying some of the flies that that they have in that journal. So now what we'll do is we'll give away a copy of Tom's upcoming book. You'll have to wait a couple months to get it, but it'll be well worth it, I'm sure. And we'll give away a couple of passes to the fly fishing show. So hopefully there's one near you. The fly fishing show this year is we're going to start out in Denver, then go to Marlborough, Massachusetts, and then Edison, New Jersey, Linwood, Washington, Pleasanton, California, and then Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So it would be any one of those shows that you would be able to attend. So let's just throw this out here. I'll make this pretty easy tonight. What was the length of the world record taimen to date that Tom talked about? What was that length of that fish? And so Tom, we'll see if we had any good note takers here and listeners. And see if we can't get some winners. And they're waiting for somebody to provide an answer here. Keep refreshing my queue here. Okay, starting to get some answers in here. And it looks like we've got some people that are right on track here. Looks like we got Rod Brashears in Amarillo, 6 foot 11 inches. Was that the right answer, Tom?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Rod, you just won Tom's book, Trout, Salmon, and Char, from Wild River Press. So, Rod, you'll have to send me your address, your shipping address, and you can do it in the same box you just answered the question in. And then when that book is released, we'll get a copy out to you. Like we say, we're thinking it's a December time period. So congratulations on that. And our second winner is Phil in California, Kentucky, 6 feet 11 inches, right answer two. So, Phil, you just got your ticket to one of the fly fishing shows. And, again, Phil, I'll ask you for your information again because I don't keep it around, but send that over to me as well, and we'll get you information on how you can get your ticket. And then our third winner is John Mateer in Denver, 6 foot 11 inches. For sure, you can go to the show in January in Denver there, John. So we'll get you a pass for that show as well. Again, send me your email address, send me your address, and we'll get you all set up. So thanks, everyone, for playing tonight and paying attention and enjoying the show. And, Tom, thank you again. This is the third show we've done together. It's always a pleasure. And hopefully there'll be many more to come. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And thanks for sharing your experience.
We're scheduled to do the show on the book on January the 2nd, I think, Roger.
That's right. We have one coming right up. And
so you're going to have to put up with me again.
Well. And that's right around the show time, too, isn't it? Let's see. The show is 4th, 5th, and 6th.
Denver show is right after that, yes.
Yeah. So it's going to be a busy month.
Be lecturing. I'm at all the shows. I'm at all the fly fishing shows.
Oh, at all of them. Okay. Good. So we've got a busy month and a busy couple months there for Tom. Looking forward. But thanks again for sharing with us and taking your time out of your busy schedule. So I appreciate it. Yeah. Hopefully all of you have found the archive on our website. If you haven't, just look for the link on the top line menu. Click on that. You get into the archive. You can search for past shows that we've done. We've done over 280 shows, which you can search for by keyword or keyword phrase, like trout or tarpon or attainment or whatever. And you'll find all kinds of shows that we've done over the past 12 years. So explore it. I'm sure you'll be pleasantly surprised. Our next broadcast will be on November 7th, and it will be 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we'll interview Chester Allen. And our topic for the show will be Yellowstone Runners. Chester has fished the migration run of the rainbow and brown trout from Montana's Hebgen Lake into Yellowstone's National Park's Madison River during the fall for many years. Join us and learn about where to fish, what flies to use, and how to find the best water for very large trout. We'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Amato Books, Whipray Key Fishing Lodge, Watermaster, Baja Fly Fishing, Wild River Press, and the Fly Fishing Show for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.